As America gets ever more diverse and its economy gets ever more global, careers in translation, interpretation, and what's called localization are booming. And that growth will certainly be fueled if President Obama gets enacted what he calls comprehensive immigration reform. 11.5 million illegals will be legal and will require a wide range of translation services, interpretation services, and localization services. My guests this morning on Work with Marty Nemco certainly know a lot about language careers. Hans Fenstermacher, he heads the Globalization and Localization Association and is the International and Professional Association for Language Careers. And in his 30 years in the field, he's gone from translator to global corporate executive and everything in between. Born in Germany, Hans speaks six languages, has a BA from Princeton, and a master's in law and diplomacy from Tufts. Hans, welcome to Work with Marty Nemco.
Glad to be here.
Good. And Renato Beninato was born in Brazil. He has 30 years in the localization industry. He headed something called Common Sense Advisory. It's the industry's foremost market research firm. He was president of the European Language Industry Association, and now is chief marketing officer of Moravia, a Czech localization company with five offices in the United States. Renato, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here talking to you and your listeners.
Great. So, while many language careers overlap, they roughly break down into three categories. The first is translation and interpretation. The second is localization. And the third is internationalization. Let's take them one at a time. So, translators translate text and interpreters translate speech in real time. Where's the growth in those fields? Either one of you.
Okay. This is Renato. So, the language space is very dynamic and very active, and the language mix varies according to the period of time in history that we go through. Right now, what I see is growing is a lot of demand for telephone interpretation, live interpretation in the medical and legal fields, and also a lot of demand for new languages, in especially Asian languages, Vietnamese, Southeastern languages, Southeastern Asian languages, and Indian languages.
Mm-hmm. Not Middle Eastern languages, not like Farsi or, you know, like no Middle Eastern languages particularly?
Those languages had a peak during the period of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and a lot of demand in intelligence in that area. But I think that that phase has pretty much passed, and now we're more in the business area. And I think that Hans can attest to the fact that, especially, we look more into the business area of language requirements than just the intelligence area.
Okay, before we turn to Hans, you mentioned something, you said telephone interpretation. I imagine what that means is that you're a third, there's a teleconference and there are two protagonists or more on the phone, and the interpreter in real time is simply translating what is spoken. Is that correct, or is it more complicated than that?
In a simple way, that is it. And but the areas of application of this service are very vast.
One of
the curiosities, I think, Marty, that you need to take into consideration, and probably your listeners are not aware, is that the United States is one of the few countries in the world that doesn't have an official language. Even though English is the language that we communicate, and it's the language of the government and language of business, officially, it's not in the Constitution of the United States that English is the official language of the United States.
And ever less likely to be, I believe, as the nation's demographics change.
Exactly. So what happens is that because of that characteristic, and because you cannot discriminate citizens because of language, like gender or any other kind of discrimination, the opportunity for the language industry to grow in the United States makes it more interesting and very active, because the government is required to provide services in the languages of, especially the federal government, of the language of the people that represent a significant part of the population of a certain area.
Again, before I turn to Hans, so you also mentioned two specific areas, content areas, medical and legal. I'm assuming that medical translation is not so much translating journals or anything into other languages, but more, because we have such a diverse population, it is the being the translator between the healthcare provider and the patient. Is that predominantly correct?
Absolutely, yes. And with the being one of the biggest areas of the market in the United States being related to healthcare and the baby boomer generation coming into retirement and requiring more health services, there is a significant demand for that.
And I'm assuming also that legal, we're talking about defendants especially, but in the business context, plaintiffs as well, who may be from another country, being somebody testifying in court either as live, real-time interpreters of oral language or translating depositions and other legal documents. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And there is... And the demand will change whether it is a criminal case or whether it is a civil case, and business law, those will have different types of requirements, whether interpretation, translation, search. There are several applications of language requirements in the legal field.
And Han Fenstermacher, have you been listening to this exchange between Renato and me about careers in translation and interpretation? What would you like to add?
Well, I certainly agree with Renato and all the points that he's making. You know, this is an industry that has been surging for many years, well in excess of the pace of the economy at large. And I think some facts that your listeners might be interested to know is that you know, the content that is being produced in the world today in terms of commercial content and content between speakers of different languages is absolutely exploding. You know, we have 2.5 billion internet users now. Last year, we had something on the order of 175 million tweets per day happening. So we're not just having the corporate content that companies are producing, which is what a lot of the experience that Renato and I have, but also what's called user-generated content, which means people speaking with each other. And so that surge is really driving the growth in these fields where all those people speak many different languages. And an important point is that probably only 1 out of 10 internet users in the world is in North America. That means the vast majority of internet sort of communication is happening outside of the United States. And that means lots and lots of languages that are coming to be necessary for companies to reach and communicate with their customers and with their audiences. So there's lots and lots of need for translators, in particular, editors, quality assurance experts, terminologists. The list goes on.
You mentioned the users. Now, so for every blogger... You know, frankly, until this moment, I never really thought about it. I blog like a fiend. I tweet right. like a fiend. I post a lot of stuff on LinkedIn, and my articles are. Is there a reason? I mean, should I, in your judgment, would it be wise for me to post these things in foreign languages? Maybe in some, in Spanish, particularly, or because that's so potent here in America, or in Asian language, and use there are these instant translation software, which of course are not perfect, but I can for free go and translate my tweets or my blog posts or whatever into at least comprehensible Farsi or Hebrew or whatever.
Well, you're raising a whole can of worms there. I'm not sure I would advocate that you go do that. Again, it may depend on the audience you're trying to reach and the sort of the user base that you're attracting. There are those softwares out there, and they work to varying degrees of success. I don't think any of them is what I would call ready for prime time, and we could spend a whole show just on this topic. But I think it's wise for you as a blogger and any blogger to be aware that the audience for your content isn't just English speaking, and it isn't just in your immediate surroundings. It can be all over the world now. And likewise, you may want to consume content from all around the world. And so it's important for you to have a means to access that content. And that's one of the challenges that our industry has right now, is to how to go about doing that, both in terms of the volume and the speed at which this content is being produced.
Well, you said it's important to keep in mind. So if I write a blog, you're telling me don't go and have it translated, and it's not really mission. I think most bloggers or most we just feel like we would like to be more inclusive, and we would like to enable somebody who speaks Mandarin to, if we have some thoughts about how to overcome procrastination. I'm a career counselor, that should be able to be readable by somebody who speaks Mandarin. but it's not something that it's worth my hiring somebody. It's just I figure, well, if it's it may be imperfect, but why don't I just go and translate my blog post using one of those instant the best of the instant translation softwares, and it'll be readable enough. What's wrong with that thinking?
Marty, well, if I may,
sure.
There's nothing wrong with that thinking. Machine translation is an important part of any language strategy. It is free. It is good enough. It's not perfect. And sometimes good enough is just enough.
Right.
And actually, for the translation industry, we consider machine translation to be one of our best friends.
Really? How so?
In the sense, well, it's good advertising for us. Because machine translation, there are so many cases on the web that you can go and search for machine translation errors, and you will find lots of funny situations that have happened with machine translation. But the role of machine translation is to give you a gist, to give you an idea of what the content that you're searching is. More important than machine translation is your search strategy, so that people can find you. So if you have search keywords for search, those words can be translated by machine translation. People will find you. And if you see a surge in demand of readers to your blog in Haiti, you may decide to translate your professionally your website into Creole. So machine translation is that door opener. People know it's not perfect. Mm-hmm. They don't rely on it 100%. And when you're going to deliver professional a product for commercial product purposes that is going to generate you some revenue, you will want professionals to be involved. Mm-hmm. In a way, as Hans indicated, there is an explosion of content all over the world. Mm-hmm. And the logical development of demography in advanced countries is that the population is going down in most European countries, in Japan. And the biggest economies, as the economies grow, the population growth goes down. So you have an explosion of content, a reduction in the growth of the number of translators, of human translators. So there is room for automation and technology.
Mm-hmm. So
even freelance even professional translators use machine translation as a first pass, as an accelerator. But it's not the solution to all problems.
Right. That's what it seems. As I'm listening to this, it seems to me the template that I'm creating is for something that is not mission critical, where there can be some indeed malaprops, you know, fine, like my blog, where nobody's going to die if there's a misinterpretation of a phrase or a sentence, then that's the cost effective and wise thing is to use the best of the machine translation, the internet-based software. If it's something important, I think is what you just said. Let's say it was legal or medical. Then it seems like machine translation should be your first pass. And anything that looks anomalous, a good translator would say, okay, now I've got to go and mechanically fix those. So it becomes, rather than translating every word, it's more like an editing function of the professional translator. Do you buy that analysis?
Well, I buy that analysis in part. What I would say is talk to a professional if you're using translation for any business requirement. If it is for selling, and Hans speaks fluent German, so he can quote
Willy
Brandt. And but there is it's part of the strategy. You have a whole group of tools at the hand of the translator, from dictionaries to websites to machine translation to translation memory. There are many tools that are available, as for a doctor who has also their sources of information or any type of instruments that they use in their day-to-day lives.
A professional,
this is a very work-intensive and intellect-intensive work environment. The translation working, communicating between two languages, it's something that is quite complicated.
Before we leave,
Marty,
it,
if I could add just a couple of thoughts, I wanted to say two things. One
sure.
is that there's a lot of mythology around machine translation that gets talked about more than almost anything else. And I think what that means is that people who are interested in using it or who are interested in working with it really have to have a way of setting their expectations properly about machine translation. It has a place. And it's very usable in some cases and very unusable in others. So, you know, Renato's absolutely right. You should analyze this from a professional perspective, decide where it's applicable and where it's not. I think the other thing is that machine translation has a very sort of almost checkered kind of history with the industry, and it's been around for half a century, but it's still a long way from perfection. And so, you know, it's not there's not one view about machine translation. Increasingly, it's becoming mainstream within our industry. But there is some fear that it will replace human translation. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah,
but I think that's the wrong view. The view is, as Renato said, the view is this is a tool. This is an important augmentation of our capabilities that allows us to meet needs that where human translation simply just couldn't do it at all.
Got it. Let's go off that. But I do. We'd be remiss if we didn't. If the two major languages that people here in the Bay Area certainly are mainly interested in translating are Spanish and Mandarin. Is there, while fully recognizing their limitations, is there a piece of Spanish language automatic translation, machine translation that you would like to say is particularly good for Spanish and one that's particularly good for Mandarin?
I don't think you could say that at this point, because one of the things about machine translation, without getting into too much detail here, is that it's based on language pairs, which means the source and the target language have to be specifically set up and what's called trained to be able to produce that translation. And it's also domain specific, if for the most part, so to be done really well, which means that a medical MT system that's set up to go from English into Spanish would do a horrible job, possibly going the other way or in a different domain. So, it really depends a lot on the application. That's really, I think, the point we're trying to make.
So, Renato, do you want to take are you willing to say at least something that's a good starting place?
No. None of them are really excellent, and okay. Just for your listeners on a day-to-day basis, the free tools, Bing Translate from Microsoft on the Bing search engine and Google Translate are the two that are available. Google is available in 160-something languages.
Wow.
And Bing, I think it's about 30 languages.
Wow.
They, like we said before, it's a gist, it's a tool, it's useful for basic communication. I personally use it every day, because even on reading Facebook posts of friends in Norway or in Indonesia, for that stuff, these tools are perfectly fine.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. Our topic, careers in language. We're starting about careers specifically in translation and interpretation, which is real live speech translation. We're going to talk about other language careers, but without even having given out the phone number, let me tell our listeners who they're listening. I'm talking to Hans Fenstermacher, who is the director or executive CEO or whatever of Globalization and Localization Association. That's the International Professional Association for Language Careers. And I'm also talking with Renato Beninato, who is has been the president of the European Language Industry Association and now a chief marketing officer of Moravia, which is a localization company. We'll talk about localization in a moment, with five offices in the U.S. We've got calls on the line before I even give out the phone number, so let's just go right to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Hans Fenstermacher and Renato Beninato. What's your question or comment for them?
Hi, I'm Lisa, and
Hi, Lisa.
I'm a medical interpreter, state certified from the state of California.
Hmm.
I also work as a medical interpreter in a hospital, a major hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And myself and my coworker, Susana Rice Concar, she has a master's in public health, and she's been working at this particular hospital for 15 years. We encountered the year 2011 a promotion of a sort of like medical translation app that was being promoted by a couple of doctors, and we ourselves investigated this app ourselves and looked at it, and we realized that it was lacking incredibly in any kind of capacity to be able to even go through the patient's personal medical history, rather. And also, we did a paper that we published at the National Council on Interpreting and Healthcare websites that was called, Medibabble, which was the name of this app. And we also talked and studied a lot about how these computer-generated translations actually are very harmful to specifically more vulnerable populations that happen to be limited English proficient, because the people that use it have no inkling whatsoever to its limitations and further perpetuate inequality, both in healthcare as well as in other areas as well. And basically, there is no substitute for human interpretation because the language itself is dynamic and context-driven. And there are so many different regions, even Spanish, Latin American in particular. Within Latin America, there are 21 different countries that have so many different regionalisms and so many different specific ways of defining symptoms and feelings that are very regional, historic, are limited to the history as well, and generational.
An excellent point.
Yeah,
which no machine could ever reproduce.
Yeah.
So actually,
we've gotten your point that machine translation can't get the nuance of the many different languages. And Renato, you wanted to respond?
Well, I just wanted to say that she's 100% right, and especially in a medical environment and in the United States, a country that is so prone to lawsuits and problems. There are tons of examples of medical errors caused by bad interpretation and bad translation. It's wise to always have a professional, certified medical interpreter in
right.
any situation.
And I think the key point there, is it's not just to have somebody bilingual, but to have somebody who's actually a professional interpreter who understands the domain. So often you see in hospital settings in particular that somebody's brother or daughter or whatever is being used to do the interpreting simply because they're quote-unquote bilingual. That's a huge mistake and can lead to, you know, equally dangerous kinds of situations. So she's absolutely right. This is a critical area, and you don't want to leave it to to unqualified people or unqualified machines.
Got it. We're kind of covering the same ground in the beginning. It was unfortunate in a way that the caller was saying what you had already said and agreed to. But she did raise a new point, which is this. She said with great fervor that it's not just Spanish, but that there are, throughout Latin America, there are hundreds of dialects, each with their implications, each with their own cultural sensitivities, histories, etc. So is it eventually a very difficult, it's probably more difficult, you're not going to be able to, let's say somebody is from rural Bolivia, and, you know, we're lucky to get a medical translator who speaks Spanish, but that person is probably from Mexico City or Guadalajara, you know. Are we doomed to, especially in a serious medical context, are we more likely to get closer to the true implications or the true intonations and the true meanings? If we do, if already Google has got 160 languages, if they went and they parsed out those 160 languages and had, you know, five dialects of each, isn't it more likely that we will get better net translations from all of those than we would from the generic Spanish-speaking medical translator?
This is, we go into the very nuances of the space. Spanish, there are 21 countries that speak Spanish, and the third largest Spanish-speaking population in the world is actually in the United States. It's Mexico
right.
first, Spain second, and the United States
right.
third. So there are dialects, there are different meanings. You have 41 words for popcorn or things like that. But anecdotally, you have a level of universal Spanish that is used for generic context. It's said the university Spanish. It's the same. If you go to any university, you have books published in basically Spain, Mexico, and Argentina that are used in universities all over the world in Spanish-speaking universities. This nuance is more on the day-to-day activity and on marketing material. And we in the translation industry are very used to that kind of situation, and we're happy to advise buyers and clients who need to make the decision. But I think that one point that we're failing to cover here, and I think is very important to your listeners, is the skill required to be
mm-hmm.
a translator.
Mm-hmm.
There are different skills involved in language in the language business. You need different skills to teach a language, to speak a language, to teach a language, to translate a language, and to interpret a language. All these things required different skills, different training, and different personalities even, to do those different types of jobs. usually when we talk about translation, it's not just converting topics from one language to the other. You have also, as Hans mentioned before, the domain expertise. So you don't want an accountant doing medical translators. You don't want an engineer doing medical translations. You don't want to have people who are not qualified in a certain area to do the translation to that area, as much as you don't want an accountant to be doing your medical exams. Okay. So you have a lot of niches and specialization. And a common mistake that people make is that any person who's bilingual can be a translator. There are many opportunities in the language business, not necessarily only in translation for bilinguals.
So it's really clear that obviously that this is a career that is not easy to be qualified for. You probably have to be a native resident of that other country so you understand not only the language and its nuance, but its culture, etc., and have a content area of expertise, whether it be medical or legal or business. Let's get, I'm looking at the clock here and we are really running out of time. So what I'd like to do is move off the world of translation and interpretation and into the next category of language careers, which I find particularly fascinating, called localization. What's localization? Hans, why don't you take it?
Well, localization, generally speaking, is the process of adapting a product or a service to a specific market or locale. Generally, the most obvious way that you can adapt something is by language. You can translate it from one language to another. But localization encompasses much more. It encompasses things like cultural differences, customs, technical features. It goes very deep down into minute detail, things like graphics or fonts, dates, times, currencies, sound effects. All of those things make up a process of adapting the product to appeal to that market and in some ways for it to look like it is a natural part or a natural product in that market.
Got it. So if I'm a company or a nonprofit or a government agency that's trying to do a publicity campaign, the colors even of the that are used, the fonts, of course the language, the understanding of what makes people excited or scared or ready to buy or ready to donate or whatever, Right. That's what you're talking about. Is that correct?
Right, exactly. And the other thing is that within our business, localization generally, and it's not universal, but generally refers to the more technically oriented kinds of jobs and work that we do. So these would include things that are software, websites, firmware, device localization, things that have an engineering component, that have increasingly technical aspects that have to be taken into account.
Renato Beninato, can you give an example of a specific project that a localization expert might, for example, in software or an engineered product or whatever, can you give an example of where this localization expert could really add value?
Let's pick up something that we all use every day. You use an email account. You have a Gmail, a Yahoo Mail account, and so on. This is essentially a text editor, where you need to write your text in your language.
Right.
You have a friend or a family or a relative in another country, let's pick up Korea or Japan, and they have to interface with that same tool in their own language. So instead of saying file or save and send, those buttons will be translated in their own languages. And when they have a text editor, instead of saying A, B, C, and the alphabet, they will type in their own language. Those are engineering tasks, changing the look and feel of the product so that it feels like Yahoo Mail or Gmail in Korea was developed in Korean, and that person just hits the button send in Korean, and the email comes and arrives to you. So there is an engineering layer in the background that makes this different formats talk to each other. But the job of a localization company is to make, like Hans said, the product adapted to that local market. And that applies to your Excel spreadsheets and PowerPoint presentations. People work in their products in their own language. And our job as localizers is to transform that product into something that looks local.
So I was particularly interested in, Hans, you had mentioned that one application and it might be, for example, medical devices. Can you give me an example of how a localization expert would take a medical device, let's say a cardiac stent or a knee brace, and localize it to, say, a Latino audience?
Sure. One of the things you have to keep in mind is that products, I mean, stents and things like that might be more simple in terms of not having an interface built in. But if you took something a little more complicated, say a dialysis machine or something like that, now you start to have all kinds of aspects. You may have readouts on the machine that have to be read by technicians or nurses or doctors. You have documentation that comes with that machinery that has to be teach you how to use it, teach you how to maintain it, teach you how to clean it, and so forth. There may be patient facing information that goes with that machine, such as here's what you need to know about using this
Hans, product. We're still back to language examples. I was having a sense that localization goes beyond translation.
I can give you a more practical example in the same
not language oriented,
not
translation. Yeah.
Most of the world uses the metric system, and here in the United States we use the imperial system. All these conversions are critical. If you're not doing the right conversion, the temperature reading is not in Fahrenheit, it's in Celsius. And these are localization items. Even the size of the paper in which the instructions are printed is different. In the United States, we use the letter size, and all over the world, it's the A4 size. So all these small details that make up the mix of the whole product so that it feels local are the job of the localization. The localizer, the individual and the company that does the job.
All right. Let's take one more call. Let's go back to the phones. Again, I haven't got the number, but let's get one more call and see if we can take this in a different direction. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco with Hans Fenstermacher and Renato Beninato. What's your question for them?
Hi, Marty. Yeah, I was commenting earlier I was going to talk about the language, which you want to move off of. But I think the general gist of this conversation would be more helpful to the general public if it went in the direction of what can we do and how do we do X, you know, with these various tools, as opposed to the people who are calling up, which we've already beaten to death, of how we shouldn't use these tools. And I just wanted to throw that out because I work in small groups, whether it's meetings or one-on-ones, and for those kind of things, automated things work better because everyone sitting there knows the fallback and the failures and takes them into account. Once you distribute it outside the group that's doing the process is when the dangers occur.
Yeah. What I think, because of the interest of time, I'm going to actually move this conversation. Thank you for the call. I want to move this to, you know, the caller was talking about the practicalities. Certainly what motivated me to do this segment is President Obama has said that his number one domestic priority in his second term is comprehensive immigration reform, which is going to mean that there's 11.5 million illegals who will become legal very likely. What implications does that have for any sorts of language careers?
Well, what I would say, maybe to set the stage there, is that generally I think, and Renato, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think immigration is one of the bigger drivers for translation and localization in this country. Mm-hmm. There may be more of an effect on interpretation because as you have new undocumented immigrants who are beginning to integrate into mainstream society, you're going to have more needs in, you know, places that we mentioned already, hospitals, government, the courts, and so forth. In terms of translation business, I think a lot of those markets, a lot of those languages are already being addressed. Certainly something as obvious as Spanish, Chinese, Korean, some of these major languages, those are already in process, so to speak. So I don't know that I would expect a surge in business there. The one thing I would add, though, is that I think there could be a very significant boost to the Hispanic market because the majority of those undocumented immigrants are going to be Spanish-speaking, and that is a huge, huge market in this country and growing very fast, much faster than the general population.
Exactly.
So that's what I would say about that.
I agree with Hans. I think that the impact of the immigration reform is going to be very little. What might happen is that we're going to have more legal Spanish speakers trying to enter the translation market as employees. But I think that in the language business, there are very strict selection processes to identify those people who are capable and who are not. And I don't expect a major impact, as Hans said. I think that there's more opportunity if we look into how much more the United States is exporting to other countries and how much more other countries are exporting to the United States, because then there is opportunity. One of the areas that I think is interesting to your listeners is I speak English. I don't speak many other foreign languages. I have a good sense of Italian or French, and I would like to be in the translation space. There are opportunities as editors. An editor, a reviewer, like a final text editor, can be a person with excellent English skills and moderate foreign language skills. And there are also opportunities for American citizens who are native English speakers to go abroad and teach English. Most of the English speakers don't realize that they have a very valuable asset. The fact that they speak native English is very appreciated in many countries abroad. And you can go and have a career as an English teacher in a country that you fancy, in a nice tropical beach somewhere in Southeast Asia, Latin America, or Asia.
Last question, in terms of, let's say I am somebody who is a native speaker of another language, or at least have very moderate competence, and I want to either get additional training that will make me more hireable, or I simply want advice on how to land the job. Is there any non-obvious advice you have for us?
Well, I think one of the things to say is that there are in terms of translation training, so specific to the industry that we're in, there aren't very many programs. There are a few around where you can get trained in translation once you have linguistic skills. And then there are places like the Monterey Institute, which is a world class program in this kind of thing. But the language training. One of the things that I think is really important that people kind of don't think about too often is that language training isn't something you can do quickly. It takes time and it takes practice. Mm-hmm. And so if you can't decide at a certain point, next month there's a job opening someplace for somebody who speaks French, I think I'll learn French. That just doesn't work. It might work more easily with other kinds of expertises, but not with linguistic skills. So one of the keys I would say is if you have any proclivity for language, if you have any interest, start taking classes early, take them as much as you can, practice as much as you can, because it's the kind of thing that builds over time.
I got to tell you, my take really is that, you know, with so many careers out there, really, unless you are a native speaker and really culturally sensitive, I think, you know, it may be wise to not go that route. It's such a long route as an adult to learn a new language.
Yes.
That's one guy's opinion. What do you think, Renato?
Marty, I think that also there is this element of pleasure for the language, right? And language is something that is fascinating to everybody. I think that there was a study that was published recently. Everybody was talking about that even bilinguals are sexier than monolinguals. So it helps you even in that space.
There you go. Well, I think on that note, that is a perfect note. On that cheery note, I want to thank you both, Hans Fenstermacher and Renato Beninato, for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. Hans is indeed the head of the Globalization and Localization organization called GALA. If you Google Globalization and Localization Association, I'm sure you will find lots of information. I know you will. I've looked at the website. And Renato Beninato is the chief marketing officer for Moravia, which is a localization company with 5 offices in the United States. I want to thank you both for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Marty.
Great. Be well. All right. I would like to, in the remaining 20 minutes we have on this show, I would like to change topics. I think we have, to use the caller's term, maybe beaten this to death. I was hoping there was a little more non-obvious advice that I could get that was more practically relevant to you, but it ended up being fairly, I think, pretty common sense, obvious advice from my that was provided. But now I'd like to try to do my best to add some more value for you. So if you or someone you love could use some career advice, I do what I call 3-minute workovers here on the show, and this is the time we're going to do them. Or if you have your pitch, either because you have a business idea you want to run by me, or the pitch you give to prospective employers about why they should hire you, Any career-related problem, I love to help you. The phone number now, while there are a couple of lines lighted up, is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Do you know, Eric, if the callers are related to language or not? Let's go to that caller. Great. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Are you there?
No, I guess he's gone. That's fine. So, okay, great. Okay, so what I want to do is I think I want to share some careers. I had created a for U.S. News or AOL, I don't remember, for one of those two, in my weekly column, I wrote an article called 25 Careers to Consider for 2013 and Well Beyond. And I wrote that government numbers don't tell the whole tale. Most of the list of best careers are based on the U.S. Department of Labor information, but that's very often inadequate because often the information was collected years ago. Some of that information is supplied by each field's professional association, which has an interest in making the career appear desirable. And also the Department of Labor reports only objective statements, and not everything important in a career can be reduced to an objective fact. So I developed a list of careers that combine both the facts and this, what I call the ineffable. So hopefully it'll be more useful to you. A career that I want to talk. I've been sick of talking about healthcare careers. So I want to talk about non-healthcare careers that that are likely to grow. I want to talk about being a data analyst. You know, ever more business decisions are based on analyzing who buys what, when, and how. Database analysts are mining the often unimaginably large data sets. We call it big data is the current phrase for it. Data sets that provide information. And I really think that a particularly interesting set of that data set, that big data, is social media. Your Facebook posts, your Twitter posts, your Pinterest posts, your blog posts, and of course, your purchasing choices on websites, that creates enormous information about you, your buying habits and other habits, who you donate to, etc. So if you are indeed somebody who is looking for a career that's data-centric, being an analyst on big data is very important. I guess while I'm on that big data thing, you know, it's kind of the general concept is obvious. But the field of high tech is changing dramatically in terms of what they're looking for. And I was pleased to read an article called, I think it was called something like Top 10 Hiring Trends in Tech or something like that, by a woman, her last name was Ulrich. Yeah, Catherine, I got it here, K-A-T-H-R-Y-N, Catherine Ulrich. And there are a few points she made about how things are changing in tech hiring that are really critical. The real high profit margins, as you know, companies really are quite scared right now about the going back into recession, et cetera. So they are looking for really the software tends to not be a high profit margin item generally because it becomes a commodity. It's there on the internet, but services, which are more customized, that's where the high profit is. So if you're a sales oriented person, see if you can become more of an expert in selling high tech services. Another example. Anybody, you know, everybody seems like everybody under the sun says, I'm a social media marketing expert. I'm a social media expert. Well, you know, I think version 1.0 of social media marketing has largely failed. It has generated a lot of business for consultants, and every company feels obliged to have their contests and their coupons and their, quote, new announcement of their new product. And instead of just posting that on their website, they post it on Facebook and LinkedIn, etc. But it ain't really paying off in terms of dollars very well. And so I really think that there is an enormous need for people who really have some smarter ideas on how to build customer loyalty and or direct sales using Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter and Pinterest and et cetera. Another thing is this. In every field, it is the people who create the tools for a hot field that make the money. So, for example, in screenwriting, screenwriters, only 1 in 1,000 ever make enough money to even pay back the training courses. But the training course people are the ones who make the money. If you want to do voiceover, 1 in 1,000 voiceover students who spend the $7,000 on Voice One or Voice Tracks or whatever those training programs break even. But the ones who create the who create those programs make the money. Similarly, in high tech, if you're somebody who trains high-tech salespeople, if you are somebody who provides training for use of esoteric software or training in Ruby on Rails or the latest high-tech software, that is going to be where there's, I think, money is going to be made. Gamification. Everybody these days wants to sugarcoat a lot. So whether it be in social media or whatever, taking your products and services or your ads and making them a game. The gamification is one of the hottest words in Silicon Valley. I encourage you to think about how you might incorporate that into your search for high tech. Now, another thing, and then we'll go to the phones in a minute. We always think about, and I had a guest on my show who I really loved last week, Stanley Chow, the author of Selling to China, but we were talking about selling to China. But there are a lot of foreign companies, especially in Asia, that are interested in selling to America because America's economy, while it's kind of stuttering, is certainly better than some economies, and it's still a huge economy with a lot of money. And so if you are somebody who could help an Asian company particularly be their American representative, whether in marketing or sales or in localization, helping to adapt a product that is selling well in Asia to better suit the American markets, American psyche, etc. That, I think, is a great job. And finally, for job searchers, you know, the era of the standard job interview. I mean, for low-level jobs, it's still the same old crap. They're asking you, tell me about your strengths, tell me about yourself, tell me about a problem you solved, blah, blah, blah. But the more desirable employers and jobs are getting more sophisticated. They are trying to see whether you can add value. So in your interviews, it is important for you to almost verbally present a business plan for what you would do to either create more revenue or streamline a company or do just where you would add value more than the dozen other applicants who have applied for the job. Also, in your thank you letters are dead. They're over. They add no probability to your increased chance of getting a job. But if instead of the thank you letter, you write an influencing letter, which indeed presents a business plan or how you would add more value to your company than the competitors in that cover letter, that's going to be of great help. So those are some of the tips on how to take the generic advice. Yeah, high tech is growing, but rather to help you be a little ahead of the curve and help you be the one to land the job. Now, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. How can I help you?
Hi, yeah. I was listening. I just tuned in late to the interpretation and translation program you were having.
Yes.
And I'm actually a language teacher.
Okay.
I'm right about to retire in a couple of years, but I want to get into translation or interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what suggestions you have for me to be able, because I actually do this already for the educational system, for IEPs, which are individual education plans.
Special ed kids, right. Students. So what if I asked you, what if I said you had your own answer right there? You have the language skills, you've already done some of it. What if I ask you, as I tell so many of my clients, be laser beam focused. Decide that you're going to be the queen of IEP translation. If you don't have really great skills yet for it, really make sure that, especially in the dominant languages of Spanish and Mandarin, and perhaps Russian, that you understand the key words in IEP. For example, it could be words like visual processing.
Okay.
Or, you know, a lot of those jargony terms, you know, 94-142, least restrictive environment. There is endless jargon in the special ed world.
Yes,
if you made sure that you knew all of that, and then with that expertise in tow, you then went to the special ed directors of every district, school district in a reasonable geographic distance from your home, so you're not sitting in gridlock for, you know, an hour each day, and explain that you have been a teacher, a language teacher for a long time. You've been called upon by your own district to be the IEP translator, and you found that you love that work, and you've taken additional steps to become really very knowledgeable in all the key phrases that are likely to occur in IEP meetings in three or four different languages. I'll bet you that you will find yourself with a retirement, pre-retirement career. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. But what I'm wondering is, what do those interpretive jobs go for? Because right now in my district, I'm only getting paid hourly, which is $30 an hour. Which
right.
is
I'm sure it's going to be the same because this is not something they need 40 hours a week. It's not a union benefited line job where it's, you know, like a teaching job or a principal job or whatever. This is, you know, on an as needed basis. They don't need a translator for IEPs every, you know, 40 hours a week. So that's why I'm asking you to contact a lot of these agencies, a lot of these districts and even counties, the county offices of education. You know, if you live in what city?
Yeah, I live in Alameda.
Right. So the Alameda County Office of Education, Contra Costa County Office of Education, the counties are a whole different educational bureaucracy on top of the districts. So if you contact the counties that do, they're responsible for a lot of special ed services. You may contact 10 or 15. You may get just that $30 an hour, but you will be, and you'll be doing some driving, kiddo, and that's going to use up gas, especially as gas now is back over $4 a gallon.
They usually, when they can't have somebody local, they get somebody else, and they pay them $120 an hour.
Okay. I am not knowledgeable enough about the hourly rates in this field, but it doesn't matter. The point is, if you make the systematic search across a larger enough number of districts and county offices, you'll see what the range of pay they offer you. And if there really are some people happy to pay you $120 an hour, congratulations. And if the best you can get is 40 or 30, so be it. But at least you will have found out what the market will bear. Make sense?
Exactly. Got it. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hello. Good afternoon, Marty.
Hi.
Yes, I'm calling because I need some help with my education and my experience background. My friends tell me that I do have so much to offer, but I don't see it. And I want you to help me to think out of the box.
Okay.
I have an economics BA, MBA, and in a... It's a private institution that is not very well known, but I did get good education there. And I'm a native Mayan and Spanish speaker that has an accent in English. And I really don't know what to do with my career. And I have experience in microfinance, but I actually want to get out of that.
Okay, a couple of questions. First of all, I'm curious, you know, everybody genuflects before Kiva and all the other microfinance and Muhammad Yunus. Why do you want to get out of microfinance?
It's probably because I haven't had a good experience. I haven't had the support of a good boss. And I just don't know. I think I have, it fulfills me to work with the people, but I haven't had any support from upper management.
Okay. You also said you went to you got a good education at this private MBA, econ or MBA program. Where'd you go? What school?
I went to Mills.
Okay. So what do your friends, you said your friends all say you have so much to offer. What do they suggest? What do they say you have to offer?
Well, they think that I should be in the Latino market and try to, while we were talking today, localization, that probably something like that should be my niche.
Okay.
And I'm a good community leader. I have been working with the community, Mayan community, for a long time.
Okay, so what I'm hearing, when you go into Mills, the three pieces put together, Mills is a very non-profit, they're a for-profit college, or they're a private college. They really emphasize the non-profit. You use the word long involvement in the community. That's just non-profit, and you were in the non-profit world, microfinance. So what if I said that you need to work for to make a list of, and again, the key is focus, 10 nonprofit, you went to Mills, I'm assuming you live in the East Bay. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
so what I'd like you to do is to make a list of 10 fairly large nonprofits that serve the Latino community and convince them that because of that unique combination of the MBA and deep knowledge of what you said you were Mayan. I found that very interesting. When you say you're Mayan, how is that different from Mexicano?
Because it's a language, and it's a culture in the southeast of Mexico.
Okay.
It's the whole peninsula of the Yucatan speak one language.
Right, the Merida, Cozumel, et cetera, Chichen Itza, right?
Yes, that's it.
Okay,
yes.
And how might that be applicable to today's people in the Bay Area?
Well, for one thing, for example, at work, I'm able to get very involved with my clients because I can speak the language, or when I'm doing I'm trying to recover my funds, the company funds, I can speak in the language.
What I'm saying is I understand Spanish, but you made a point of differentiate yourself, and you didn't call yourself a Mexicana, you called yourself Mayan. So I'm trying to see if that's a unique market advantage to you. How might you use that understanding of the Yucatan Peninsula and the people and the culture? How might you, if I were the head of a Latino nonprofit, how might your background in being Mayan, how would that help you? How would that help my nonprofit?
Wow, I've never thought of that.
Is it possible that there is an organization, maybe even a for-profit, you know, again, I know how nonprofit your background is, but I'm wondering if there's a company that's interested in selling products on the Yucatan Peninsula where you could say, mm-hmm. given your MBA, that you're not just from Mexico City or Guadalajara, but you're from the South, you're from the Yucatan, that you would be the ideal person to help develop marketing strategy, localization strategy for how to sell their American product to the people of Mérida, etc. Does that make sense?
Yes. Okay. I mean, it does. I just have to see what product or services it will be.
Right. And so if there is a particular kind of either products that either you have particular interest in, maybe you care about environmental products or skincare products or biotech products, find American companies that are international, that may be already doing business in Mexico, that may indeed need somebody who's got expertise in that southern, as you know, the culture in Mérida is very different from the culture in Mexico City, and mm-hmm. that you are going to be a person who'd be excellent as a member of the marketing team. That seems to make the most sense. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, yeah. Thank
okay.
you.
I thank you very much for the call. Why don't you hang up? Why don't you hold on? Don't hang up because somebody wants to talk with you, I guess. So stay on the line.
All right.
And in any case, unfortunately, that is all the time we have. Let me give you an update on what's going to happen next week. Next week, it's going to be very fun. You know, corporate life, especially here in the Bay Area, it tends to be criticized, ridiculed, demeaned, etc. Is it really that bad? Is it worse than that bad? Is it better than that? Well, my guests next week are going to be the authors of the new book called The Org. That's Columbia Business School's Ray Fissman and Harvard Business Review Press's Tim Sullivan. They're going to take us through the logic, or seeming lack of logic, of those organizations. That should be very fun. In any case, that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Eric Jansen, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please do join me again next Sunday at 11. In addition to that, that interview, which will probably be the first half hour of the show, in the second half hour, I will do 3-minute workovers on callers. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.